Dark Wraith Publishing presents the Heartland Collegiate Compendium, academic lectures in economics and business. This is Principles of Microeconomics, Econ 101, Section 1 for Spring Semester 2012. Lecture 23, delivered on April 24, 2012. The title of this lecture is Income, Poverty, and the Prosperity of Nations.
Today, income, wealth, and the prosperity of nations. I caution that in the final 10 minutes of this lecture, you will see some very graphic, disturbing imagery, which is part and parcel of this subject. It is taught from an extremist right-wing perspective, where prosperity is the result of capitalist enterprise, and it is taught from a leftist perspective, where prosperity is the siren call of the capitalists to bring the rest of us to our knees in a cycle of violence and poverty. I will take an approach that covers both of those. The problem is that when we talk about prosperity of nations, we are met with a variety of measures that could be used. Certainly at the level of the nation itself, we could talk about one measure that will be emphasized more when you get into macroeconomics. That would be gross domestic product. That is a quite popular way of measuring not just whether a nation is prosperous or not, but it's also a way of measuring whether a nation is progressing economically or it's falling into a recession. So gross domestic product is probably the place, at least a good place to start with talking about the prosperity of a nation. Gross domestic product. Now, the definition of gross domestic product, which you will be given again in macroeconomics, is the value of all newly produced goods and services, the value of all newly produced goods and services, created within a nation's borders in a given period of time. Created within a nation's borders in a given period of time. The value of all newly produced goods and services produced within a nation's borders in a given period of time. Now, in a given period of time, you could talk about monthly, quarterly, or annual GDPs, the most popular being the quarterlies and the annuals. Now, this is newly produced goods and services. This does not include used goods that are resold or things like that. It also doesn't include goods and services that are produced for a nation but outside of that nation's borders. Gross domestic product is just the things that are new. And it's also, I should qualify that, all newly produced final, put in there, final goods and services. That way we're not counting, double counting things as intermediate goods, like the steel produced for a car. We would count the car, but not the steel that was made for the car. So it's all final, newly produced final goods and services. So we would certainly like to have that number. A nation with a larger GDP certainly is a wealthier nation, but it has its flaws because, you see, a GDP, gross domestic product, you could have a nation with a very large GDP, but it could have a very large population. So, for example, I could have country A and country B, and the GDP of the two countries is the same. Let's say it's $1 million in measured in dollar terms. And there's a problem too, making currency equivalents. But GDP of both countries is $1 million, but the population of country A is 10,000 people, and the population of country B is 100,000 people. Clearly, in terms of GDP, those countries are equivalent in terms of their wealth, but or the income, I should say, as far as GDP is concerned. But obviously, the population of country A is doing better per person on average than country B. So we have another measure, per capita GDP. And per capita is Latin for per head, a head count. And this would be an average. And so if I were to look at that one, I would say, well, the wealth of the country A would be $100 per person on average. And the wealth of country B would be only $10 per person on average. So on a per person basis, taking it from the macro to the micro level, and here you're seeing a lecture that is a transitional lecture between micro and macro, you would certainly say that country B is more prosperous on the personal level, at least on average. So these metrics that we are laying out here, GDP would be a first metric of the prosperity or the wealth of a nation. But then we see that there is a flaw in that because that does not take into account the size of the population. So we can go to another measure, per capita GDP, which captures something about the individual level. Now, that doesn't mean that the GDP is something we shouldn't look at. Absolutely, we should. But it is what I'm doing here is I'm developing, as this lecture proceeds, this understanding that one measure does not tell you everything. You have to look at a broad variety of measures to get a larger sense of what's really going on in a country. Now, interestingly enough, on a GDP basis, the United States is top dog. We just produce an unbelievable amount of final goods and services per period in this country. There are other countries that are up and coming and might eventually overrun us. China comes to mind as one of those countries, but it's certainly not the only one that's roaring ahead on GDP, on absolute measure. But interestingly enough, the United States is not the top dog on per capita GDP, not at all. There's one country which is an oddball. Oh, let me ask you, what country would have the highest per capita GDP? What would you think if you were just kind of feeling around for countries? What would you say?
It's probably one of the BRIC countries, though.
What? Which?
Brazil, Russia, India.
You're missing China. It by a mile.
China?
Oh, there. No, they suck. They suck.
They have a lot of people.
Oh, I mean, China on an individual basis, meal includes here, doggy. Canada? No, Great Britain. No, actually, Great Britain kind of sucks. They had a bad time back in the early 1990s, and thanks to a couple of people who are now considered the wonderful people of the world. They really wrecked Britain. But interestingly enough, and I'll bet you've never heard of this. Well, maybe you've heard of the country. I've been there. It's called Luxembourg. It's a little kingdom in Europe, a little place. And it is filthy rich people who live there. Not many, and they are all filthy rich. If you are in Luxembourg, you are either filthy rich or you are one of these dregs that they bring in to do the crap labor for all the rich people there. And then they kick you out when the day is done. Go away, you know, you're done cleaning our toilets. But, I mean, it's like this beautiful kingdom. Everything is perfect in it. And everyone there, it's sort of like there are places in the United States you can go where it just doesn't look like a normal place. Jackson Hole comes to mind. But Luxembourg is just awesome. And the people there are filthy rich, and there are not very many people there. So you have this massive per capita GDP, even though on the Richter scale of GDPs themselves, it's not, you know, it's a small GDP compared to some behemoth like the United States or Canada. But, I mean, on a per capita GDP basis, I mean, those guys don't want for a cheeseburger at night. None of them do. So the per capita GDP is actually kind of surprised a little bit. The United States has a decent per capita GDP. But there's a problem with per capita GDP. You see, because that's just an average. An average of the gross domestic product per person. It doesn't take into account how that population is distributed with respect to the income of the nation for a given period. You see, because I could say that the average person in country A makes $100 a year. But I could say, well, it might be that there's just one person who makes $900,000 per year, and the other people in the country all end up taking the $100,000, and that's their share. So the per capita GDP is highly misleading in a country where there is income inequality. So we have to go to another measure that would take into account how the income is distributed. And there are actually two parts to this. There's a graphical representation. It's called a Lorenz curve, and I'll show it to you in a minute. And then we want to get a number on it, because you can look at graphs all day long, and you can have Lorenz curves that look different, but you can't tell which one's better, which one's worse, et cetera, all that. So we need a number that we can pull off this, some measure of a Lorenz curve's essential information, and that's called the Gini coefficient. So let me go to this measure of income distribution and start with the graphical representation, which is the Lorenz curve. And it's actually kind of a simple idea to the extent that we divide the population of the country into deciles. The poorest 10%, the next poorest, the accumulated 20 poorest, the accumulated 30, 40, 50, 50%, and we usually do it by households, 50% of the households, then 60%, then 70, 80, 90, and 100% of the households. Now, obviously, 100% of the households would command 100% of the GDP. Now, you'll see these Lorenz curves done different ways, by GDP, by wealth of the household, by income. Oh, there are different ways, but we'll just sort of take a sort of like an income share of the income. So on the horizontal axis, we have percentage of households in the country. And then on the vertical axis, the percentage of income of the nation that percentage commands. And so that would obviously go the same way, 10, 20,
30, 40, 50% of the income, 60, 70, 80, 90, and 100% of the income.
Now, ideally, if you were talking about sort of like a socialist's dream come true, you would say that perfect income distribution would be when you have 10% of the house, the poorest 10% of the households command 10% of the wealth income. The lowest 20% command 20%. The lowest 30% command 30%, et cetera, on up to the point where 100% of the households command 100% of the income. So a country that would be perfect income distribution, so that the average, the per capita GDP would be what was actually happening, would be a horizontal line, sort of a socialist dream. No group commands any more than any other group. But the reality is that that's not the way any country on earth looks in terms of an actual GDP. For example, you could have a country, just no countries particularly in mind, where the poorest 10% command 1%. Of the income. The poorest 20% command, let's say, about 4%. The poorest 30% command maybe 6%. The poorest 40% command maybe about 10%. Poorest 50% command around 16%. The poorest 60%, the lowest 60% command, let's say, about 24%. The lowest 70% command about 30%. Lowest 80% command maybe about 55%. Lowest 90% command about 60%, and then this wealthiest 10% command all of the rest up to 100%. So in this country, where only the very wealthiest command a very large share of the income, you see a Lorenz curve that bulges downward from the diagonal. And so, as a general rule, the more a real Lorenz curve bulges downward, the more income inequality the nation will have. Now, in the real world, these Lorenz curves are generally, when we plot the data for countries, they tend not to be smooth. They're kind of jagged and jerky. But it is the case that countries around the world, to a greater or lesser extent, have Lorenz curves that bulge downward from the diagonal. And so visually, we can look at these Lorenz curves and say, okay, it appears that this country has more income inequality than that country does. But again, these can have all kinds of different shapes. Realistically, I could put up two Lorenz curves, diagonal going through, and it can get kind of confusing when you're looking at them. For example, I can see one country that has a belly bulge like that, where many people are poor as dirt, and then this rich, super rich class of, like the 1%, as the Occupy movement said, have almost everything. But then you have other countries that can have
more gradual, or I'm sorry, steeper at the beginning, but then the middle class does better. See how in a country like this, the middle class is doing okay, but you have this dirt poor low class group. In this country, pretty much everyone's in bad shape except for a super rich group. So they can get a little confusing in terms of, well, which one is worse? And that gets into a subjective kind of area. It would be good if we could get some kind of a number so that we could compare number to number from country to country and also see how countries are faring as time goes on. Does this number change? And if so, in what direction does it change? And we do have that. What we do is we say, all right, the bulge between the diagonal and the actual Lorenz curve has an area. The larger that area is, the more income inequality there is. So ideally, all we would have to do is have some mathematical way to measure that area. And then we could say, okay, here we go. The way we do it is if you typed into a search engine, Gini coefficient formula, the formula would absolutely, I mean, it's almost daunting, but it's a very simple idea. Just measure the area under the Gini between the diagonal and the Lorenz curve, and then scale it from 0 to 1. In other words, make the formula so all numbers come out between 0 and 1. And call that the Gini coefficient. A Gini coefficient, and so this will be our third numerical measure of the prosperity of a nation. The Gini coefficient, G-I-N-I, after the inventor, the Gini coefficient. It will be a number between 0 and 1. 0 would mean that there is no area between the diagonal and the country's Lorenz curve. So 0 would be perfect income distribution, perfect income equality, like a perfect socialist nation. A number that was 1 would be essentially a giant block. One person has all the wealth and everyone else has nothing. The ultimate catastrophe in a way, as far as the rest of everyone but that one person or that one household was concerned. So this number, this Gini coefficient, would be between 0 and 1. And then we can lay countries out and rank them. So how do those numbers look? Well, let me bring down a map here. And this is a color-coded map of the world, color-coded by the strength of the Gini coefficient, by how close it is to 0 or how close it is to 1 by country across the world. And let me see if I can get this up here. And you'll bear with me here for a moment while I fire this projector up. But the picture that emerges is interesting and telling. And this map is actually a couple of years old. It has gotten significantly starker. A couple of things have in it that are rather disturbing. But behind the map, I'm going to talk about just the map and some of its visuals. The closer that a Gini coefficient is to the green, the more equal the distribution of income.
The closer it is to almost a black or blackish red, the worse the income distribution is. Now, if you look across the world for the greenest countries, you'll see that the two greenest, and it's a little difficult on this projector, seem to be these two. That would be Finland and Sweden. Scandinavian countries, which are highly socialist in their policies, tax the hell out of everyone and then distribute the income rather generously to each within the society. So that's a little bit not surprising. But there is another dark green country there as well. By the way, Greenland itself is this country right here. This is Greenland. It's part of Finland, actually. So it's kind of, on some maps, you'll see it as the same color as Finland itself. But there's another country that is dark green on this map. Do you see it? Look over on the right. What country is that? What is it? Japan. Japan has one of the most equal distributions of income in the world. Possibly the most equal distribution? Well, that doesn't seem to make sense from a socialist slash capitalist perspective. Because even though Finland and Sweden are most definitely socialist, so they'll tax the hell out of everyone and then distribute income equally, that's not the way Japan works at all. It's a capitalist country, a brutal capitalist country. What would be going on there? To look at that one, you begin to realize that it's not just about politics, it's about culture. In Japan, the culture is keyed to the idea that everyone should succeed. Everyone comes home a winner. Now, that is, I'm not a rah-rah supporter of Japan. I came from the era when we were still a little fragile about Pearl Harbor and all that shit. But as a nation, Japan is quite dedicated to ensuring through cultural discipline, work ethic and all of that, and cultural pressures that everyone will succeed. That doesn't mean that there's not an underclass, an impoverished class in Japan. There is, but it is quite small, quite unnoticeable. A story that I was told many years ago about Japan, not many years ago, some years back, was that there was a baseball game. It was some kind of a championship game between two teams, highly, highly anticipated by many, many people. There was a very, very large attendance at the field, and then it was watched on television. The game was just a slugfest, and apparently the score got to 99-99 at the end of 9 innings. And, of course, the fans just went wild. The game ended in a tie. Well, that, of course, meant it had to go to extra innings. At the top of the 10th, one team got a run, and then the bottom of the 10th, the other team got a run. So the score at the end of 10 innings was 100-100. And 100 is a very special number to the Japanese. And they were just going cuckoo bananas. Into the next couple of innings, finally, at the top of an inning, one team got a run, and then at the bottom of the inning, the other team got a run. If 100 is a special number to the Japanese, 101 is a magical number. The fans just went cuckoo, absolutely bananas. That was the end of the game. Everyone had won, and magic had happened. The competitive concept is there. But competition is to the end of us all succeeding. That is unlike it is in other countries. So let's go around the world here and have a look. Europe is getting poor, so these lighter greens that you'll see here are not going to be quite so dark green in the next couple of years as Europe collapses into economic doldrums, as Great Britain did some years before. But certainly Europe has those greens that are indicative of relatively equal distribution of income. In many of those countries, even when they are capitalist in their orientation, they still have heavy tendencies towards socialist policies, making sure that the poor are never so poor that they can't eat. That does not mean that you don't have nefarious policies in these countries. Some of these nations are quite well known for bringing in foreigners, especially from the Middle East and from Northern Africa, working them like dogs, not counting their miserable income. And then when economic times get bad, they just kick the people out. So it's not all sunny and gooey even in these countries. But then you get into these countries over here in Eastern Europe, and you got Pakistan, and you got some of these countries where there's some oil wealth showing up, and a few countries in the Middle East. But you go down here. Oh, and there's Canada, a bunch of damn socialists with that socialized medicine and all that. But there's an interesting thing. Where is the United States? Oh, it's brown. It is not, it's kind of like in the middle of the pack. Income distribution is, by the way, in the most recent maps, it might very well become slightly red. Because in the past number of years, especially during the Bush administration, and it's continuing in the Obama administration, our country is becoming less equal in its distribution of income. Now, is that some evil? In our country, many people would say no. If you work, you get ahead. If you don't work, you deserve to be poor. Go die, you son of a bitch. That's not an evil. That's just a different philosophy. Or is it? Well, let's keep going here. Of course, you've got China and Russia. They suck. And then you got all these sub-Saharan African countries, which are just miserable as hell places. But again, you know, that's their problem. And then you got Central and South America just look like basket cases. Principally, you'll see in those countries oligarchic families that more or less have most of the wealth, and everyone else kind of just is pretty much damn miserable. Does that mean that they feel miserable? Oh, woe is me, I'm so poor. That's not how it works. Not really in many countries. The poor have their own culture. They see themselves as separate. I don't want to be like those rich people kind of thing. So it's not as horrible as you might think in some ways, but there's certainly a darkness that is cast upon South America, Central America, and then sub-Saharan Africa and parts of Asia and Eastern Europe. And there are parts of Eastern Europe that are pretty miserable right now. Other parts of Eastern Europe are doing better. I would count the Czech Republic, Czechoslovakia broke into two countries, the Czech Republic and Slovakia. The Czech Republic is doing pretty well now. Slovakia is just dying. Poland has done pretty well, although it's struggling, the economic times and all of that. And then you have some of the other Eastern European countries, the greater or lesser degrees of difficulty and income inequality. And in some countries, it's like, Russia is nothing but a patchwork of power centers driven by thugs of various flavors. China, the idea that China is a monolith of communism that has a veneer of capitalist market tendencies is extraordinarily simplistic. China is a complex country that even at the level of its military is more a patchwork of warlords than it is a monolithic military force. For example, in the slaughter at Tiananmen Square in 1989, where the students thought they could just protest and the Chinese government would change, they found out that they were butchered. Some 2,000 of them were. Interestingly enough, the troops that were sent to deal with the protesters were first contingents from urban areas, Beijing itself. They weren't going to kill those kids. They weren't going to get rough. That's why you saw the early pictures of the students having the, doing the demonstrations, that one awesome picture of the kids standing in front of the tanks. That was an awesome picture. The tanks didn't roll over, and because those kinds of troops, they were urban kids themselves. They weren't going to kill their own kind. The Chinese Politburo had to call the warlords to bring in their thug, violent, ignorant monsters from the countryside to replace the urban troops. That's when the shit got real and the kids were all slaughtered. It was essentially, that gives you a stark picture of that, of this complexity. And it's just so many ways, so many languages, so many subcultures going on in China. But across China, it is miserably poor for most people. Even in this age of they're playing with the market system and screwing our country over with the nod and the wink of our politicians and our precious economists, it's still a miserably poor country for a lot of people. Okay? But let's keep going back to the United States. It's not a country that is equal in its income distribution by any means. It's gotten more unequal in your lifetimes, especially in your teenage years. It got worse. And you were the people that it got worse for. The rich did get richer and the poor got poor. But again, the argument is, okay, that's our way. You can look at those people that have money and you can cry and want their money and demand the government take it from them and give it to you, or you can get off your fat ass and get a job and earn that place in the top tier of income earners. That's our perspective, notwithstanding the leftists and the liberals who cry, hey, hey, ho, ho, let's tax the hell out of the rich. But there's a story behind this map. There's more to it than just cultural philosophies that go back to times long, long ago in the past. There's another story if you look at this map carefully. Look at the countries that are brown and red, and even some of the yellow ones, as opposed to the countries that are green, the countries that look down their noses at we who are not as cultured as they. You have South America, Central America, the United States, Africa, the Middle East, even these countries right here, India, Australia. What do they have in common? They're all over the map, literally all over the map, but they have something in common, something that is striking. But you have to know a little bit about history to know what it is that all those countries have in common. Does anyone want to make a speculation about what it is? They were all colonies of the kingdoms and empires of Europe. Look across the world. The Dutch and the Portuguese ravaged Africa. The Spanish, the British, the Dutch, the French, and a whole lot of other Europeans pounded South America, Central America. Hell, we were a colony of Great Britain, one of the greatest empires of all time. Colonies. Colony, Australia, colony, India of the British Empire, all colonial subjects in the relatively recent centuries past. Now, what does that come to mean? What does that mean? The best understanding of it comes from, first of all, these colonial powers imposed not just use of resources, exploitation and extraction of resources, but they also imposed economic structures, legal structures, institutional ways. And when they left, those institutions survived. They are not institutions that were keyed to the indigent peoples. They were institutions keyed to colonial occupiers. You look across the world, United States is nothing but a pathetic version of the British Empire system, except we pretend we don't have royalty. Make sure you turn off your television so you don't watch our royalty in action. These countries, oligarchic families run the South American countries. Oh, isn't that just like it was in the time of the Portuguese and the Spanish? The royalty, the nobles, controlled everything. And guess what? The institutions they left behind, the people they left in charge, claiming, we are liberated. Ah, the hell they are. They're still living in the empire's shadow. Across Africa, these are countries where you have two things. One is controllers who live in the institutional environment of the occupiers that were there before, and the violent monsters who are the thugs who want to get their piece of the pie and pretend that they're for the people. Across the world, you look at the Gini coefficients in that light and you say, oh, wait a minute. This is where it started. There. That's where it started. It started in Europe, where the center of power emanated out to suck out human beings from here and sell them, to draw out the gold and all of the other natural resources from here to sell them, to profit from them. From here, where we could send our, where the British could send their dregs because they didn't want those people in their country. They were too precious to have their own criminals in their country. India, the same thing. Massive, vast resources sucked away by the British Empire. Across the world, it has happened. Look in the Middle East. Those kingdoms, you think those kingdoms are there at the behest of the people? No, those are what we put there. We created those countries. Those countries really didn't exist until the UN imposed those borders and those boundaries. And then, of course, when they throw out our chosen people, they bring in their own crazy-ass people like they did in Iran or in Afghanistan with the Taliban. Know this, though. It's certainly not a mystery as to why the Gini coefficients are distributed the way they are. We think that we are self-generating in our philosophies here in the United States. Work harder, earn more. No, that's just how colonial occupiers do things. Well, if you were more like us, you would make more money, wouldn't you now? We freed ourselves only to become continue to be the subjects of empire. Our founding fathers were absolutely adamant that we would not have a noble class in this country. We would never, ever go back that route. Well, look where we are now with the Bill Gateses and the Brad Pitts and the Angelina Jolies. We are back in empire. Know this, though. The Gini coefficient is not the only way to measure income inequality, or certainly not the only way to measure all of the different aspects of what it means to have prosperity. I can give you numbers here, GDP, per capita GDP, Gini coefficient, but I can also give you other numbers that tell other parts of the story. Let's try a couple that are my favorites. Let's try one like infant mortality rate. You would certainly argue that a country that is prosperous will not have its babies die. So that's a darn good measure right there. So let's try that measure. Let's have a look at that one. Here is a relatively recent, I published one, a version of this. It was a little older. It's a little more out of date. This is recent. infant mortality rates in the developed world. Infant mortality rates per 1,000 live births. Lowest infant mortality rate, Hong Kong. Wealthy, good. Japan, and Sweden, Singapore, Norway, keep going down. Czech Republic, Canada, Greece, New Zealand, Portugal. Oh, Israel, Cuba. Where's the United States? At the bottom. More of our babies are born and then die than any developed country in the world. Well, that's just because we have more premature babies being born. That was the first argument that came, oh, the firepower that ripped that one out. Premature babies are happening all over the world. We don't know why, but that's a really creepy trend. Oh, well, it's got to be something else. It's those damn poor people that are not getting the prenatal and neonatal care. Well, yeah, but okay, the babies are dying. Well, is that an interesting statistic, though? Did you know that? That even among second and third world, if I put those up like I did in my own graph, for which I got death threats, I should point out, showing this, comparing, we were still way down on the list. We had countries in the second and third world that didn't have infant mortality rates as bad as ours. Surprising. If you want to measure wealth and prosperity of a nation and not go with income and all that, well, let's go to infant mortality rates. Surprise, surprise, the United States sucks on that measure. And that is where, if you forgive me using the expression one more time, the shit gets real. GDP, per capita GDP, Gini coefficient, those are cold measures. A little baby between the ages of 0 and 6 months dying, that's a very hot measure of the wealth and prosperity of a nation. And on that measure, we are not doing so well at all in this country. And yet you have all these countries that do so much better. All these dirty socialist countries, look at all these countries that play with socialism and all that. National health care, by the way, virtually every country in here, national health care except for that. Now, it's not a promotion of national health care. I've talked about the deep problems with it, some of the issues with that kind of a system. However, if you go through this list, we can't even come up to the measure of Cuba. Okay. Let's take one that is related, interestingly enough. And I didn't get up a chart for this one, but live birth rate. As a general rule, higher birth rates are associated with more income with less prosperity. Live birth rate, more babies. The typical explanations are, look, in countries where women produce more babies during their lifetimes, that is an indication that the women don't have a high opportunity cost of their time. What else are you going to do? You're just going to produce babies. I mean, you don't have opportunities outside of that. You certainly can't go get a nice corporate job. You can't work for a living and postpone childbearing or limit the number of children. So that's a typical explanation of why we have high live birth rates. The women don't have many opportunities. That's the result of general economic bad times. It's also a measure of misogynistic and paternalistic policies within the countries that tend to keep women, forgive the expression, barefoot and pregnant. So as a country becomes more progressive, but also as its economic situation improves, we do see birth rates going down. And I've got to qualify one thing here. It is not an absolute measure. We do see subpopulations and subcultures where high birth rates are not associated with general poverty. In our country, we have several groups where the people are not miserably poor, but they do have higher birth rates than you would expect, than the general population. Among those, of course, the classic would be the Catholics, who produce quite a few babies. Another example would be the Mormons, who tend to have very high birth rates. although the argument that they are fairly well-to-do is a myth. Generally speaking, Mormons do tend to have their income, their circumstances are not all that great all the time. There, and then, of course, there are some other Christian groups and other religious groups that have as part of their religious directive to produce lots of babies. A good example of that is the a movement in the United States. I don't know if any of you have heard of it. It's called Quiverful. It's a group dedicated to Christianity and spreading the word through the production of many, many babies per household. Forgive me, I'm going to try to find something here. I'm not going to be able to find it. There's a family that's well known for how many babies they have produced. There was a reality TV show about the Duggard family. How many is she at now? My God almighty. And that's a lot of kids. But they are part of this movement. You produce so many children that you essentially will ultimately overwhelm the culture with the values of your religious cult. By the way, 21, that's nowhere near the record. In the 1700s, there was a Russian woman who had 67 kids. Yeah, 67. Can you imagine 67 kids? I mean, you know, and interestingly enough, many of them were born as quadruplets, triplets, and twins. And I mean, through her life, I mean, her husband was, I've seen, you know, sketches and drawings of this couple. He wasn't anything to look at, and she was certainly looked awfully tired. I mean, I had a hard time walking from what I understood by the time she was in her 40s. Anyway, say what? I mean, I actually wrote an article about, I was looking for the article I wrote about the Duggard family. I got into a lot of trouble for the article. Heavy criticism, talking about how I was going to burn in hell, you know, and all that kind of stuff. Let me check one quick thing here. Bear with me one quick second. I shouldn't do this because I know I'll get in even more trouble for showing this here. But oh yeah, here's my article about the movement, by the way, that promotes extraordinarily high birth rates of its members. Is called Gothardism. And I wrote an article about the Duggard family that got me in just tremendous trouble. I mean, religious people were criticizing me, even some liberals saying that I was attacking people for the wrong reason. Christians, oh my God, I got in so much trouble because these people say Jesus commanded them to make the women produce. So So like I said, don't be a writer on the internet. You get in so much trouble for what you do. And I mean, I wasn't doing anything wrong. I mean, here's a dark secret about live birth rates, so. And we see this across the animal kingdom, not just in people. Definitely we see it in all kinds of higher mammals, in fish. High infant mortality rates have a strong association with high live birth rates. It's called the dead baby replacement syndrome, where essentially if a population is experiencing large die-off of the babies, just sort of like this internal genetic engine kicks in to start making more babies. And we see this all over the animal kingdom. And one aspect of these high live birth rates, not always, but one aspect that can be shown as a corollary is the high infant mortality rates, especially in Africa, where the kids just die so often that the women just sort of produce more babies, just as sort of like they're biologically, to keep the species going, you just create lots and lots of your kind so that essentially not all of them can be wiped out. So these two, even though live birth rate does go down as economic prosperity goes up, that is not completely independent of the infant mortality rates going down as economic prosperity increases. So there's kind of a complex little relationship going on here that you have to kind of think about. But know this, that these measures like these are not the only ones. We can talk about, for example, life expectancy. Life expectancy in the developed world has gone up quite a bit over the many centuries. The idea, and this was the subject of a discussion, a very civil discussion with another academic who was talking about how medical knowledge and healthcare are everything to the increase in the number of increase in life expectancies. And I wrote a response to him saying, no, actually the biggest determining factor in the jump in life expectancies was not medicine, but hygiene, sewage, clearing the water, getting the crap away from where we live, making sure that people learned how to take care of themselves better than they used to. Did you know that in the, especially until recent times, if you were in a duel with someone and you were shot with a pistol and you got hit, you didn't die from the pistol, from the bullet, from the round. You died because some of your filthy clothing and your filthy skin went inside you and created an infection that killed you. That's how much we have changed, especially in the last 50 years. The idea of washing ourselves, washing our hands. It had been known for many, many centuries that washing your hands would reduce infant mortality rates. But interestingly enough, once the kids started living and growing up and their supply of labor started going up, wages started going down, the midwives and the doctors started forgetting to wash their hands again. Isn't that interesting? They didn't even know about bacteria and all that, viruses, but they did know that washing your hands, you could kind of regulate the population that way. But life expectancy, it has been going up. The problem with people living to older ages is we then have to take care of them. 100 years ago, there was no one knew about, well, there was kind of a concept of it, but it was so remote, breast cancer. The reason women didn't live long enough to get breast cancer. It's primarily a cancer of middle-aged and older women. So you didn't know about breast cancer because women didn't live long enough to get it. Diabetes. Most people died before they were old enough to get diabetes. Only the rich lived to old ages, and they were all constantly bitching about their problems with arthritis and all of that, dementia. We, as common people, didn't live long enough. Now we live longer, and unfortunately, that means that we're getting diseases that people that we have to pay for these days. I should point out, as a side note, that yes, women do live longer than men for various reasons. For one thing, at least I get to the grave and I can get some peace and quiet. I shouldn't. Okay, where the hell was I? Other ones, by the way, that are discussed. Literacy rate as a measure of the prosperity of a nation. How many of the people can read and write? That's not as great a measure as you might think. India, for example, is an extraordinarily miserable country with respect to literacy rates. And yet it is a vibrant country where it is growing. It's doing quite well. On the other hand, those kinds of softer measures, you got to be a little careful about those. Interesting, age of first pregnancy is a fairly decent measure. Age of first pregnancy going down is generally associated with a much greater likelihood of a life of economic impairment for females. Age of first sexual contact, the lower it is, the worse off the girl's probably going to be through her lifetime, just because of her values and her objectives and even her sense of herself change at the time of first sexual contact. The old joke used to be that the age of consent in most countries was the first time you were left alone with your uncle. But we are, interestingly enough, in our country, the age of consent has been rising. And interestingly enough, though, the age of sexual activity has been falling as females and males are maturing at an earlier age. Interestingly enough, about 150 years ago, the age of consent in the United States was 7 years, believe it or not. It has risen steadily over the years, but interestingly enough, at the same, and especially in the last 50 years, sexual activity has been, age of first sexual activity or awareness has been going down. There are softer measures, though, that I should bring up. The problem we have with the measures that I have given you so far, except for perhaps the live birth rate issue, is that they are, in one way or another, kind of a cold measure. In the sense that, well, we're talking about numbers. We're talking about whether, and for the middle class, whether you can redecorate your master bedroom. It does get real in some parts of the United States where the poverty is quite grinding. But even in the worst of the places in the United States, there are benefits that don't exist in other parts of the world. How do we measure prosperity of a nation beyond these things that have numbers? Let me make a couple of suggestions to you. And some of these images, I warn you, are graphic. Some of them come from articles that I have written, that I have bought royalty rights to the pictures. Others, they were public domain pictures. I'll start out with this pair of pictures. You see that little girl right there? She's holding her little blanket. She is screaming inconsolably. She and her family were having a picnic on a beach. Israeli warships came up towards the shoreline and fired at positions of Palestinian fighters at the top of the beachhead. Now, the Israelis say, oh, it was the Palestinians returning fire that butchered her family. She doesn't care. All she knows is that she is an orphan because of a conflict between two groups that just can't figure out a way to do their stuff without killing people and making kids into orphans. Check this one out down here. You know what? You know the ethnicity or the country of that girl? That's an Iraqi girl. That girl is crying because she was hurt by us in a war. How do you measure the war? Well, it's costing us $3 trillion. Never mind the cost to us. Let's talk about the cost to the kid there in that measure. Let me take you on a little bit more of a journey here. Vietnam. Oh my God, child pornography. Her clothes were burned off when we dropped napalm on her village. Our propaganda machine said, oh no, we didn't. That was a hibachi that blew up on them and burned her clothes off. You ever see napalm? You have to hold your flesh melts off. I've seen it. How do I measure that? Where are my numbers? Where is the measure of the prosperity of a nation that is under siege from a war machine of an empire that has giant bombers? That was B-52s in the sky that did that one. Let's go on here for a minute, and let me point out, what I'm trying to do is get you to understand the importance. Oh, there's another kid. How do you measure it? Well, you know, we're going to give his family some money. Just shut them up. Oh, our bad. That was shrapnel. See, that's what shrapnel does. It spatters you with little tiny pieces of metal. You can't get them out for the rest of your life. That kid will actually have some come out in his mouth every now and then. He doesn't look too happy about it. But how do you measure happiness? You know, we're economists. You're in an economics class where we always measure things, have to have a number for something. Let's try this one. That one's a good one. Oops, that's Afghanistan. Our bad, us again. And of course, if we weren't doing it, the monsters of the Taliban would do it. What with their version of Islam and their worship of a Muhammad that really was a violent man, but I don't think he would have approved of things like this either. And I don't think our Christian leaders would really approve of that either, but there it is. We did it. How do you measure it in economic terms? Is that part of the prosperity or lack of prosperity of a nation? I would say yes, it is, but it's beyond numbers. You see, across the world, what happens is that we create conditions as empire and as religious people and as drivers of civilizations and as fighters against occupiers. We create conditions that take away the wealth of nations, that take away the prosperity that could have been there. Even if they are not wealthy in money numbers, countries can be still rich in culture, rich in peace, rich in happiness. And yet, when we go into those countries, whether it is the United States or it is the Soviet Union or the Taliban or some other nutcase group out there, we're all alike because we are taking away the prosperity of nations, and we're oftentimes taking it away in ways that can't be measured. But you know what? Sooner or later, we can measure them. Because I'll tell you one thing. Those kids remember. That little girl, guess what kind of a person she'll grow up to be and who she'll remember as the killers. The Palestinians, she's a Palestinian. No, she'll remember the Israelis, and she'll remember the people who give them their money to run their war engine. That's the United States. It will become real in the fire and shrapnel at the corner of 5th and Main in our country someday. When kids like this, who are raised in a culture of war, where using pistols on the weak is part of what they learn. Whatsoever we do to these, the least of our children, yeah, that we're going to do to our own future someday. And then we can measure it, $31 billion worth of property damage on 9/11. That's all I have for you. I thank you.